One by one, he sounded the great themes of our times.
History's headlong course has brought us, I devoutly believe, to the threshold of a new America, to the America of the great ideals and noble visions, which are the stuff our future must be made of.
His eloquence expressed the hopes and aspirations of the common men all the world over.
The human race is a family. Men are brothers. All wars are civil wars, and all killing is fratricidal.
Now that he is gone, I think of the line from Pilgrim's Progress. So he passed over, and all the trumpets sounded for him on the other side.
Adlai Ewing Stevenson, born Los Angeles, February 5th, 1900. Died London, July 14th, 1965. Nationality, American. Citizenship, the world. This is a portrait of a statesman, a man who demonstrated that language and the spoken word are powers in and of themselves, who denied the supremacy of the practical cynicism espoused by so many of his contemporaries. This is a portrait of a man whose overwhelming moral force has played an important role in the shaping of domestic politics and international diplomacy. In many ways, the first 50 years of Adlai Stevenson's life was spent in preparation for the days he would make his contribution to international understanding. According to American lights, he was an aristocrat. On his father's side, the grandson and namesake of the vice president during the second administration of Grover Cleveland. On his mother's side, the grandson of the man who first proposed Abraham Lincoln for the presidency. These were his birthright. In his own right, following the completion of his education, Stevenson held a number of legal posts in the national administration of Franklin Roosevelt, culminating in 1945 with his appointment as a representative to the conference in San Francisco that established the United Nations. 3 years later, in 1948, he entered the political arena and was elected governor of Illinois in a landslide. When President Harry S. Truman announced he would not run for re-election in 1952, the Democratic Party began a search for a standard bearer. When his name was mentioned, Stevenson protested that he did not want the nomination. But the party drafted him, and he told the delegates gathered in Chicago,
"I accept your nomination and your program." "And now, my friends, that you have made your decision, I will fight to win that office with all my heart and my soul."
The Republican nominee was war hero Dwight Eisenhower, and the election proved no contest. As the return spelled defeat for Stevenson that November, he told the people, "I have lost, but I have said what I mean and meant what I said. No man can do more, and you are entitled to no less." Then he added,
"Someone asked me as I came in down on the street how I felt. And I was reminded of a story that a fellow townsman of ours used to tell, Abraham Lincoln. And they asked him how he felt once, after an unsuccessful election. He said he felt like a little boy who had stubbed his toe in the dark. That he was too old to cry, but it hurt too much to laugh."
While the electoral vote was a lopsided 442-89, Stevenson managed to roll up 27 million popular votes, 3 million more than were cast for Truman in his successful 1948 campaign. Adlai Stevenson had made his mark on the nation and his party, and in 1956, he sought and won the nomination again. In his acceptance address to the Chicago Convention, he said,
"I come here on a solemn mission. I accept your nomination and your program. 4 years ago, I stood in this same place and uttered those same words to you. But 4 years ago, I did not seek the honor that you bestowed upon me. This time, as you may have noticed, it was not entirely unsolicited."
During the campaign, he would discuss that convention in unconventional style.
"I remember at the height of the convention, I walked boldly into a marching group of my supporters. The leader was an immense woman who was clearly about to become a mother. And she was carrying a huge poster saying, 'Stevenson is the man.'"
But the result at the polls was the same as 4 years earlier, an overwhelming victory for Eisenhower.
"To you who are disappointed, let me confess that I am too. Here in America, the people have made their choice in a vigorous partisan contest that has affirmed again the vitality of the democratic process. And I say, God bless partisanship, for this is democracy's lifeblood."
Looking back on his two unsuccessful efforts, Stevenson often told this story.
"I take some comfort in the philosophy of a taxi driver who said to me one time, why did you run for president anyway? And I said, why not? And he said, if you run for president and you're elected, you've got nothing to look forward to."
In Los Angeles in the summer of 1960, the Democrats prepared to select the man who would carry them to victory in the fall. And Adlai Stevenson was the choice of the galleries.
"I won't attempt to tell you how grateful I am for this tumultuous and moving welcome to the 1960 Democratic Convention. I have, however, an observation. After getting in and out of the Biltmore Hotel in this hall, I've decided that I know who you're going to nominate. It will be the last survivor."
The enthusiasm of the spectators at that convention was brought to a near frenzy by this memorable nominating address by Senator Eugene McCarthy of Minnesota.
"I submit to you a man who is not the favorite son of any one state. I submit to you the man who is the favorite son of 50 states. And not only of 50 states, but the favorite son of every country in the world in which he is known. Of the favorite son in every country in which he is unknown, but in which some spark, even though unexpressed, by way of desire for liberty and freedom, still lives. This favorite son I submit to you, Adlai Stevenson of Illinois."
But Stevenson had mounted no serious effort to win the nomination, and on the first ballot it went to John F. Kennedy. In a meeting room in a Los Angeles hotel, surrounded by his admirers, Stevenson bid a fond farewell to the political wars.
"Here in the year 1960 was born a new political spirit in the death of an old political cause."
In two campaigns and a brief fling at the 1960 convention, he had demonstrated that moral values were relative to politics, that intelligence, wit, and meaning were vital parts of the public dialogue on any and all issues. He had reorganized the Democratic Party and paved the way for the successful New Frontier of 1960 with his own New America theme of 1956. While he did not attain the high office he sought, Adlai Stevenson left his indelible mark on the nation's political life. As one aspect of his career faded, another began to flower. President Kennedy appointed Stevenson ambassador to the United Nations in 1961. And in the years that followed, he frequently spoke out on the issues that meant war or peace.
This prodigal arms race is dangerous and deadly folly. Here in the United States, we want to save, not destroy, our fellow man. We want to devote the resources now swallowed up by this insatiable monster to the unfinished tasks of our own society. And we want to devote these resources to giving every soul on earth a chance for a better life. Yet the arms race goes on. It goes on because no nation confronted by hostile nations can neglect its defenses. No great power can risk unilateral disarmament. There is one way, and one way only, out of the intolerable dilemma, and that is a system of complete and general disarmament.
While he could call for disarmament, he was able to view realistically the twin threats of aggression and appeasement, and the need for strength.
The policy of appeasement is always intended to strengthen the moderates in the country appeased, but its effect is always to strengthen the extremists. We are prepared to meet and reconcile every legitimate Soviet concern, but we have only contempt for blackmail. We know that every retreat before intimidation strengthens those who say that the threat of force can always achieve communist objectives. Reluctantly and repeatedly, we have to face the sad fact that the only way to reinforce those on the other side is to make it absolutely clear that aggression will be met with resistance and force with force.
To him, the split in the communist camp revealed new dangers as well as new opportunities.
The monolithic communist world is full of cracks, and diversity is no longer a monopoly of any region or grouping. A world made safe for diversity, however, is not yet a world made safe with diversity. There are dangers, of course, when any big iceberg begins to crack. The fissures in the communist world have caused the aggressive lone wolf foreign policy of communist China to stand out as both more obvious and more threatening to the rest of the world.
When the situation involved conflict, when blood was being spilled, Stevenson's words could be exceedingly simple and extremely clear.
The doctrine of militant violence has been rendered null and void by the technology of modern weapons and the vulnerability of a world in which the peace cannot be ruptured anywhere without endangering the peace everywhere. The people of Laos want to be left alone. The people of Vietnam want to be left alone. The people of Cambodia want to be left alone. When their neighbors decide to leave them alone, as they must, there will be no fighting in Southeast Asia.
During the Security Council debate on the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, Stevenson showed he could be tough when he cornered the Soviet delegate with this blistering line of attack.
Do you, Ambassador Zorin, deny that the USSR has placed and is placing medium and intermediate range missiles and sites in Cuba? Yes or no? Don't wait for the translation. Yes or no?
I am not in an American courtroom, sir, and therefore I do not wish to answer a question that is put to me in the fashion in which a prosecutor does. In due course, sir, you will have your reply.
I'm prepared to wait for my answer until hell freezes over, if that's your decision.
Stevenson was grieved when representatives of the emerging African nations, whose causes he often championed, launched attacks against the United States. And on occasion, he felt obliged to unleash the fury of his words on them.
Racial hatred, racial strife, has cursed the world for too long. I make no defense of the sins of the white race in this respect. But the antidote for white racism is not black racism.
But whatever the issue, and no matter how bitter and frustrating the debate, Stevenson kept a single theme running through his approach to the important problems with which he grappled, that the United Nations was the world's best hope for peace. At ceremonies in San Francisco, observing the 20th anniversary of the United Nations, Stevenson revealed his view of the organization's meaning and role in world affairs.
Man, in his civil society, has learned how to live under the law with the institutions of justice and with a controlled strength that can protect rich and poor alike. This has been done within domestic society. And in this century, for the first time in human history, we are attempting similar safeguards, a similar framework of justice, a similar sense of law and impartial protection in the whole wide society of man. This is the profound, the fundamental, the audacious meaning of the United Nations. It is our shield against international folly in an age of ultimate weapons. We must make it grow and flourish, arbitrator of our disputes, mediator of our conflicts, impartial protector against arbitrary violence. Mr. President, we have the United Nations. We have set it bravely up, and we shall carry it bravely forward.
In his final address to a United Nations organization, Adlai Stevenson made an eloquent plea for peace. He spoke to members of the Economic and Social Council meeting in Geneva, Switzerland, only a few days before he died, and told them,
"We travel together, passengers on a little spaceship, dependent on its vulnerable reserve of air and soil, all committed for our safety to its security and peace, preserved from annihilation only by the care, the work, and I will say the love, that we give to our fragile craft. We cannot maintain it half fortunate, half miserable, half confident, half despairing, half slave to the ancient enemies of man, half free in a liberation of resources. No craft, no crew can travel safely with such vast contradictions. On their resolution then depends the survival of us all."
When Sir Winston Churchill died in January of 1965, Adlai Stevenson spoke for the United States in special memorial ceremonies in Washington's National Cathedral. The words he used to honor Britain's great statesman seemed to fit Stevenson as well.
"We shall hear no longer the remembered eloquence and wit, the old courage and defiance, the robust serenity of indomitable faith. Our world is thus poorer. Our political dialogue is diminished, and the sources of public inspiration run more thinly. For all of us, there is a lonesome place against the sky. For him, humanity, its freedom, its survival, towered above pettier interests. Like the patriarchs of old, he waited on God's judgment. And it could be said of him, as of the immortals that went before him, that God magnified him in the fear of his enemies, and with his words, he made prodigies to cease. He glorified him in the sight of kings and gave him commandments in the sight of his people. He showed him his glory and sanctified him in his faith.